Hey, girlfriends, welcome to another episode of Girlfriends and Goals. We're your hosts, Miosha
and Samaria.
This podcast is a space where we'll talk about friendships, life goals, a little bit of pop culture, and all things womanhood.
So some of you guys are probably aware that October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And in 2 years of doing this podcast, we have not touched this topic. So we are very honored to have a special guest with us so that we can have a discussion. So it's going to be a good episode. And if you are listening to this on YouTube, watching this on YouTube, please make sure that you subscribe to the channel, give this video a thumbs up. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please make sure you leave us a 5-star rating and consider writing a review. All right, so our guest today is Ryan. And Ryan is a friend from my past who has agreed to come on and share her story. So a lot of what you'll be hearing today is from her. So I'll kick things off and just ask you to tell us a little bit about you, about your story. Where were you in life before you were initially diagnosed?
Okay, about me. Well, I'm originally from Dallas, Texas, born and raised. I am an educator. My career in teaching began. I taught fourth grade, everything, and loved teaching fourth grade, but did not like teaching everything. So then I moved into middle school, and I taught math, and I loved teaching math, and I did not like middle schoolers. So,
yeah, middle schoolers are a lot.
Child, middle schoolers have the devil in them, and it takes a special person to deal with multiple middle schoolers at a time, and that is not my ministry. There are some people who that is their jam. It was not my jam. I don't understand middle schoolers. I didn't understand middle schoolers when I was a middle schooler, so I especially don't understand middle schoolers now, so or at that time either. So anyway, said that to say that I went back to school and got a second master's degree in counseling, student affairs. And so that's how I met Samaria at church in Atlanta, because I moved to Atlanta to work for the AUC consortium. Mm-hmm. And so I met Samaria there. We were on the praise team together at the church that we attended. But by the time I met her, I was already 2 or 3 years in as a breast cancer survivor. So I was diagnosed, I was teaching fourth grade. I had just started school to get my master's in counseling and in education. I was 28. This was 2008. I found it because I pretty much felt it myself. It was in my armpit. I knew that armpit is considered breast tissue. I felt something. It felt hard. It was like round and hard. So I asked someone that I went to church with in Texas. I was still in Texas at the time. One of my friends that I went to church with, who's a nurse, I asked her, was it something that I should be concerned about? And she was like, well, yeah, you should at least go get it checked out. So I did, went to the doctor, well, let me back up. Okay, so prior to me finding that, what I also had was uterine fibroids. My stomach was really distended. People were asking me, was I pregnant? I didn't really know much about fibroids by then, but I went to a gynecologist. And I went to a white male gynecologist. He told me that I have uterine fibroids and I would never have children. And he's like, I can give you some Xanax, right? You know, I can give you some Xanax if you want some Xanax. And that's what he said.
What?
Yeah. So that was like around, so in 2008, that had to have been around like maybe, I don't know, March, April, somewhere up in there. So I was devastated. The friend who's a nurse was like, don't listen to him. And you know, just find a black doctor. So I did find a black doctor who was like, yeah, you do have fibroids, but you know, we can try some things. So the thing that they decided to try was to have a myomectomy, which is a surgery to remove your fibroids. Basically, like, especially at that time, like a C-section cut. So the plan was to have that surgery in December. So then fast forward to what I was telling you before, along that time, during those months that I was waiting to have that surgery is when I felt the lump in my armpit. So I went in and they were like, well, you're young. It's probably nothing. They ultrasounded. They did see the lump, but they were like, it's probably nothing. It's probably benign. You're young. And since you're already going to have this surgery for the fibroids, we'll just remove that at the same time. No worries. So in December, I went in to have the surgery, the myomectomy and the lumpectomy to remove the lump in my arm. And so once it got sent back to pathology, I was in the hospital. So from the fibroids, I had I had very heavy bleeding. Like I passed out. You know how they, when you have surgery, they try to get you up and moving as soon as possible. I stood up and passed out. And so I lost too much blood. So they had to give me a blood transfusion, 24 hours blood and platelets. So while I was in the hospital having the blood and platelet transfusion from the fibroids, the doctor came in and told me that the lump that they removed was in fact cancerous. And so yeah, that is how I got diagnosed in the hospital already from the surgery. So what else did you ask?
No. I was actually going to ask a follow-up question to see, okay, like if there's like family history, because you were like doing checks. So is there a family history, a known family history of like breast cancer?
No, I was not doing checks in the traditional sense of like what you see on the little pamphlets. What I was doing, I mean, I always just like feel my body. Like you take a shower, you put your lotion on, so you kind of poke around. And so when something doesn't feel the same, you kind of know it, or at least I did. Like I knew something was there that had not been there just from me doing that type of, just me touching myself as I, just from me, yeah, like, you know, putting lotion on myself and those kinds of things. Like I just could tell something was not right. But I did not have any family history that I knew of. Now, after this process, I found out that my paternal grandmother's sister, so my paternal great aunt, had breast cancer, and so did her daughter. And they were going through their treatments kind of similar around the same time as me, but that's not close enough for that to be considered a real, like, right, true family history. It's more like mother, grandmother, sibling.
Yeah,
is when it's more considered to be like family history.
If you didn't have this fibroid issue going on simultaneously, do you think they would have, I guess, biopsied the lump? Because I've had an experience where I found a lump, and because of my age, I don't want to say they were refusing to biopsy me because of my age, but all they did was the ultrasound and was like, oh, it looks fine. And I'm like, well, how do you know unless you look at it? So was it just a chance thing that they just were like, oh, we'll go ahead and take it out? Or did they biopsy it before they took it out?
No, they did not biopsy it. I got all that stuff after I was diagnosed. Yeah, I mean, obviously it's kind of hard to say what would have happened, but certainly the fact that I was already going in for surgery made them feel like, let's just take it out, as opposed to trying to like do a bunch of investigating on the front end. I was already going to be having surgery. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, like, you know, when the person did the ultrasound, again, they were pretty nonchalant about it. Like they were saying, well, you're young, it's probably nothing. So like, if I wasn't already going to have surgery, who's to say, like, they probably also would have been trying to tell me to wait or right, something. For sure. No one ever has ever asked me that, but,
and you express certain issues around things that are associated with maybe being more midlife age. they can push back and say, oh, well, probably nothing. It's likely nothing. But obviously there are cases that differ from that. So you said that you didn't have any other physical symptoms other than the fibroid issue. You had nothing else showing like, okay, something else could be wrong other than the physical lump.
No, nothing else.
Okay.
Yeah.
So could you kind of talk us through just the emotions? Because the picture that you've painted, it sounds like there was already so much going on. I can only imagine just the emotional toll that it took. So if you want to just share what the emotions were surrounding that, and not just yours, but, you know, those around you, family members.
Yeah. Well, okay. So when they told me, it was one of those kind of out of body experiences. Like you're there, but you're not there. Like, you know, on TV when someone is talking and then you kind of hear like a vacuum, that's kind of what it was. Like he said it and then I didn't really hear a whole lot else that he said after that. I kind of just, zoned out. Initially, numbness. Then, I was scared, because, once they brought it to me and they did the lumpectomy and all that, the doctor said that it was, that they have a team of oncologists that look at special cases. And since I was young, I was a special case. So they had a team of like 8 doctors looking at my case to determine like what they thought the best course of treatment was, because once they did a lot of the testing, it was diagnosed at like stage 0 to 1. So I caught it really early. So their recommendation was to have a mastectomy, but not chemo or radiation. Mastectomy being a removal of the breast tissue. Immediately I was just like, take them both. Just kind of really scared about dealing with it. And I was just like, take them both. And so the doctor was like, no, he talked me out of that. In hindsight, I'm glad he did. Because it was really a really fear-based response. So initially, like while I was in the hospital, I was just scared. Other feeling that I felt was just kind of guilt. My mom was there with me. At the time, I was pretty much estranged from my father. I hadn't really spoken to him in a long time. So I was close with my mom and my father's parents. Like they, you know, were much more involved in my raising than he was. So both sides of my family are from Texas and Dallas, like several generations back. So I had all my family there in the city with me. My mom was in the hospital at the time with me when I got diagnosed, and she didn't really let me see her cry or be upset. But I already felt bad. And so I know that her thought was like, she didn't want me to see her upset, because then she knew that I would have been even more upset than I was. So she kind of held it together for me. That was initially it. Now I had a whole lot of testing, poking and prodding. Like I did again, end up having a biopsy. I had all the things. They do a bone scan. They do full body like MRI. They do a lot of things to determine staging, to determine the like kind of cancer it is, like what it responds to and doesn't respond to, if it spread, all those things. And so all those tests, you know, determined again that it had not spread, and that stage 0 to 1. So it was determined for me to I had a lumpectomy, which they removed the lump and then they removed a couple of lymph nodes in one surgery, and then I went back and had later on the mastectomy where they removed the breast tissue. So that happened like a few weeks later after they did a bunch of testing. But that's really, oh my God, this is like 15 years ago at this point. Gee whiz. So just about doing my math, 18. Mm-hmm. Yeah, about 15 years. So, I'm trying to think. I probably am skipping around, but yeah, that's really, I was scared initially. And then I felt bad because I was kind of, I felt like I was being a burden to my mom, because she pretty much had to stop everything so that she could take care of me, like after surgery. But I think through treatment, like through that whole process, I kind of just was like, let's just get it done. Like, I didn't really give myself a lot of time to sit in my feelings. I just was like, let's do what we gotta do. We're gonna beat this. We're gonna get through it. And I just powered through. So I didn't really feel a whole lot after the initial like diagnosis.
If you don't mind me asking, so the initial lump was in your underarm, and that's a part of the breast tissue. Maybe it's just ignorant of me, but them recommending or you having a mastectomy, is it because the tissue is all connected? And so I guess the thought was to remove it, so to remove the possibility of it coming back in that area.
Armpit is considered breast tissue. And so whenever they remove the tissue, it's to stop the spread. So like it hadn't quite gotten into my lymph nodes yet, but with it being in my armpit, that was probably the next place it's gonna go. And once it gets to your lymph nodes, then it starts to go other places in your body. So the thought is to remove all the breast tissue and some lymph nodes to keep it from spreading elsewhere. But they didn't think that I needed chemo and radiation because it was so early in the process, like I was told.
So how long did it last from diagnosis to, you're in the clear? You start your journey.
I was diagnosed December 19th, 2008. I had the mastectomy, I want to say July of 2009, so 6 or 7 months was that process. Or wait a minute, no, that's not right. March 25th is when I had the mastectomy. July is when I had the surgery, like the reconstructive surgery. So it was really a couple months. So yeah, December 16th to March 25th. So I considered March 25th my cancer-free anniversary because that was when they removed the breast tissue, and so there was no more cancer in my body. And I took meds, but I did not do any chemo or radiation. So I was pretty much done at that point.
So you mentioned earlier that you and I met after this period. You said about 2 or 3 years later. So how did that experience change how you lived your life moving forward? Or did it?
Oh yeah, it did. So I mentioned that I didn't really feel a lot when I was going through the treatment. So all the feeling came after. I was 28 in December of 2008, and my birthday's in September. I just celebrated my birthday like a week and a half ago. My birthday, so I was still 28 when all of that happened. And I had a mastectomy, and back then a mastectomy was pretty much like scooping out all of your breast tissue. So I have a huge scar. They removed my nipple, everything. They tried to take some of my tissue from somewhere else in my body. I can't remember where, but they took some tissue from somewhere and tried to like fashion a nipple, but it kind of fell in. So I didn't have a nipple. I have a huge scar, and no breast tissue. So that was quite traumatic. So like once I got done with everything, then that trauma started to set in. And when I say that I was glad that the doctor convinced me not to have a bilateral mastectomy, it's because physically that's the worst physical pain I've ever felt in my life. I discovered that I am allergic to morphine through this process. I went through a lot of trauma, just, you know, getting the doctors to listen to me about the pain that I was feeling. So like long before those conversations were being had, like among Black women, that was already my experience. And I was having those conversations with people because, yeah, I had to fight for everything. Like my mom and my grandparents and the people that were coming to see me were having to like cuss the doctors out and kick up a fuss, because they were being dismissive of my pain the whole time I was in the hospital. And my surgeons were all Black, and most of the nursing staff was Black. But the one, you know, but it's just a thing where you're in the hospital system, and people just, you Black woman, people just don't listen to you. So there was that. And then again, so this happened. I was 28. I was not 30 yet. And so I'm just in like my young adult years with what I felt like was a deformity. So it kind of really stole my confidence. All of that. I didn't, and this was also, you know, which I hate to say it like this, but because it makes me feel old, but it's just like, therapy was not a thing that people were talking about doing. Black people were talking about doing. Depression and mental health were not, you know, widely held discussions like they are now. And so I was pretty much entering depression and didn't know that that's what was happening to me. But yeah, that's kind of where I was. Like right before I moved, so I moved to Atlanta in 2012. And I turned 30 in 2010. I was born in 1980. I turned 30 2010. And I was avid churchgoer all the time, super churchy and all of those things. And I would be in church just crying, like Kirk Franklin, I Smile came out around mm-hmm. that time. And we were singing that, and I'm sitting here just like at church, just crying, I Smile, and just all the feelings. I was feeling everything. So all the feelings came once the treatment was over. Like once I got through that, it was like everything kind of really heavy loaded in me, and I was not doing well. So, because of all of that, like, I was on leave a lot from work. I was in school at the same time. So like things at work were not going well. I was absent for half the year because of that. So like they didn't invite me back after that year to the place that I was working, like to the school that I was working. Like they didn't invite me back there. And then I couldn't find a job in what I went to school for. So I was just like in this limbo time, and so I was like, yeah, I was unemployed for like around 2 years, and also like depressed from that. And so my pastor and one of the ministers on staff sat me down, and they were talking to me, and they were like, I think you need to see a therapist. And I wasn't resistant to it, but I just was like, I don't have no money for a therapist. I don't even have insurance right now. So they paid for me to go to therapist, to go to therapy. And I went to a therapist that was a Black woman therapist who, you know, was also like from like a Christian perspective. So she was kind of talking to me about those type of things too. And she was gonna like recommend that I see a psychiatrist so that I could get on meds. But she was like, I just want you to try something first before we go there. So she was like, every day you need to walk outside in the sunshine. Like if you go to the gym, it's not the same. You got to go outside in the sun for a minimum of 15 minutes. You need to walk. You need to move your body. And you just do whatever you got to do, like pray, talk to God, whatever. So that's what I did. And I came to understand that like it was, I had to go outside in the sunshine because the vitamin D is a natural healer, a natural, it can help to, it helps to do a lot of things to get real actual sunlight. One of the things it does is it can help regulate your like your brain chemicals, because that's part of depression that people don't understand, is that it's a chemical imbalance in your brain. Like, it can be triggered by traumatic life events that, you know, are not biological, but your body's response to it can throw off your levels, and you sometimes do need medication to readjust your levels. But she was like, just try to go outside and walk in the sun. But you guys got to do it every day. And so that's what I did. And so, you know, I did start to notice that I got better. And through that time, which this might be a, it'll be a little bit of a tangent, and please stop me if I like talk too much, because I can go on. through that time also, I kind of started to feel like a spiritual shift too, in that, like, I told you I was super churchy. Like, my pastor is around the same age as me, he and his wife, they're the same age as me. So like every Sunday after church, it would be a big group of us would go out and eat, like literally every Sunday, or we'd stay in the church and be talking all day and doing all that type of stuff. And, you know, especially back then too, you single, you black, on the one hand, and you're a woman, on the one hand, it's like, oh, it's great, you're single, because now we can, like, use you to do everything in the church. And then on the other hand, every sermon is like, and you single ladies, what y'all need to do is, you know, so you getting two different messages when you're in the church, when you are a single and black and a woman. And all that was coming to a head, because again, I'm close to 30. And so that's, you know, red light, you're 30, about to be back, you know, all that, I'm feeling it. So one day, and so my church, I grew up AME, and with this pastor, I chartered a new church plant, basically. I helped to charter a church plant. So we're in the new church, and he was kind of like Pentecostal in his way of preaching. Like, he did a lot of hooping and laying on hands and all that type of stuff, right? So, which I didn't grow up, I mean, the type of AME I was, we weren't like super Methodist, but we were not super Pentecostal either. We were, you know, closer to Baptist, but not, you know, closer to Baptist, I would say, than like full on Pentecostal. So wasn't nobody touching and laying, you know, all that. Got around him, that's what it was, right? So we're in the church. And so Dallas, you know, Potter's house is in Dallas as well. So we had this guy who would be on the music ministry at Potter's house, but he was good friends with my pastor and their wife, because I think they went to school together, whatever. So he would come and like minister, you like sing and stuff at church, you know, all the time, right? Now, you know, I think you know, okay, so like, pastor does the thing, we're at the altar, he does this, we do what we're supposed to do, we fall, right? So then, we fall out, and our hands, like our wrists, end up like kind of touching each other on the ground like this. So the pastor calls us in the study, and he's like prophesying that we're supposed to be together. And I was like,
that escalated quickly.
Okay, because our hands touched when we fell.
I said, well, now here's the thing, sir, pastor, I don't believe that person is into women. I think that they are, you know, not into women. And he said, basically, I'm paraphrasing, but he basically was like, well, that God is giving you this assignment so you can change that.
Oh, Lord.
And I said, oh, no, sir, no. So I was so like gung-ho and all in that, you know, because he would always, you know, prophesy, and some of his prophecies would always be, you know, you're gonna marry this type of man, you're gonna do this, you're gonna do that, all the things you want to hear, that's what the prophets say, you know, whatever. So he would always say stuff, and I'd be like, okay, you know, we'll see. And so he said this though, and this was the first time that I was like, oh, so no, he don't know everything, because I know that the Lord that I serve did not tell you that my husband don't like women. My God did not tell you that, sir. And if he did, he didn't tell me first. And I just feel like God would have ran that by me before he told you that. So something in the milk ain't clean. So that was my first time feeling like, okay, I have been too dependent on this person to like tell me how I'm supposed to think and feel about God and all the things, and I need to break away from that. So like once I moved to Atlanta and met you all, that's kind of the space that I was in. And so I got into that church because they were really like the small groups and things were all about like teaching you how to read the Bible for yourself. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yes, this is what I need, because I need to see what's up in here, because you telling me stuff.
I need to see what's up.
No, Lord didn't tell you that. Mm-mm.
Oh, man.
So that's kind of where I was, but I was still super churchy. I was still really, and I will also say that like the trauma that I experienced from the mastectomy kind of coupled with me being super churchy and super, you know, rule keepy about all of that, kind of, I was able to kind of hide my self-consciousness about my body behind me being like abstinent and all of that. So that's kind of where I was. I kind of just retreated in that way. So I mean, I was like, you know, outgoing, I think, and everybody knew my story, but that's really, those are the things that I was wrestling with.
Mm-hmm.
Was like trying to feel out my own spirituality, coupled with dealing with the trauma of what happened to me, coupled with being at that important age of knocking on 30 and not being what I thought that I would be at that time. All that was kind of converging.
Okay.
During that time.
So I want to push forward. I, like you said, you were super outgoing. Something that's interesting, something that I heard from the first time from you, right, ever, was you got this opportunity to go to, was it Abu Dhabi? Was it Abu Dhabi? Okay, just making sure. But yeah, you got this opportunity, and that's so like, it stands out to me because someone had told you around that time that you were too old to be doing that. And now it's like with social media and stuff, it's so prevalent. But I remember like that being the first instance of hearing someone saying, oh, well, you need to be settling down and having kids instead of going to Abu Dhabi and experiencing life. So yeah, I just wanted to mention that because I thought it was very interesting. There are a few things that I remember of you. And I told you about the whole natural hair thing before we started recording, but the Abu Dhabi thing I thought was the coolest thing that I had seen someone do. So yeah, just wanted to point that out before moving into the like next phase of your journey.
Yeah, which is actually kind of crazy.
I forgot about that.
The thing that she had gone through for someone to say like, oh, you, what you should or shouldn't be doing. Like, actually, I've been given an opportunity.
Well, it was a guy trying to date me. That's what it was.
Oh.
It was a guy from where?
It was a man that. So I met him at somebody's house party. I went to FAMU. He went to FAMU, but we didn't know each other while we were there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met him. We went on one date and I was like, okay, whatever. He though had decided that I was supposed to be his wife. And I didn't get the memo about that. So, but we literally went on one date. And then we went on the second day. And after the second day, I told him that I was leaving. And so he got pissed that I said I was leaving, because he was like, you too old. Like, you need to be here because we supposed to be together. And I was like, dude, I don't even know you. Like, why would I alter my whole life's plan? Mm. And I just met you.
Yeah.
So yes, that's where that came from. He was trying to tell me that I needed to stay there and settle down and have babies, because he decided that I was supposed to be the mother of his children. And I just didn't know that, because it had been 2 days. So there, that's where that came from.
Wow. So fast forwarding a little bit, you go through cancer again. after being in remission for years. One, if you don't mind briefly sharing how that came about, how you found out, and then what was different for you mentally or emotionally the second time around?
Yeah, so yes, I had lived in Abu Dhabi for 3 years. And so I was working in student affairs with college students when I was in Atlanta. I went overseas and I taught seventh grade math again because they were hiring teachers. So that was kind of my way of getting overseas. And so I did that for 3 years and I was ready to come out of the classroom for good. And I wanted to work in college access and persistence. And I knew that pretty much only charter schools did that at the time. And so that I had to kind of be open location wise as to where I was going to live. So I ended up finding a job with a charter school here in Chicago. So it's the same one that I work for now. So I've been here ever since. But so that was 2017. I moved back into the country and I moved to Chicago. And so, yeah, by that time I was coming up on 8. I had been like cancer free for about 8 or 9 years, close to 10. When I got diagnosed again. So similar situation, as I'm doing my thing, I just feel around, see what's there and what's not. And I noticed just some lumps along the side of my implant. Cause by this time, like when I had the mastectomy, I had the reconstruction, it was the implant. So, and they don't usually, do mammograms or anything on that side because it's almost completely an implant. But I again was like going in for my mammogram on the left side and I was like, hey, can you just do a ultrasound over here because I feel stuff. So that's what I did, and they did a biopsy, and pretty much from the biopsy she was just like, yeah, this don't look good. So I got diagnosed the second time, and this time I felt everything immediately. I was very angry and very scared. I was very angry because I really thought that God had told me that I was not going to have to deal with cancer again. And so I felt very angry and very betrayed, I guess is the way I would say it. And I just was like, I don't have it in me to do this again. And this time they were like, it was caught early again. Like they still said it was like a stage one or so, but, they're like, well, because it's the second time, you need to do chemo and radiation. So when I moved here, I was dating somebody. I didn't move here for him, but he happened to live here. And so we were dating. His mother had gotten diagnosed with breast cancer for her first time. Like a while before, a few months before this. So like he's dating me, talking about not marriage, but he wanted me to let him shoot the club up. Like he wanted to get me pregnant because he wanted a baby, because we're like both close to 40 now. By that time we're pushing 40. He wanted a baby. So he was like, just let me impregnate you. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like go away. Anyway. So that's what, he was on. And so, but I was like, I've been diagnosed now. Like, this is a lie. If you can't deal with this, it's fine. Like, we can still be friends, but just tell me now. Like, don't tell me that you're going to be there for me.
Yeah.
And then not that mm-hmm. I can't handle that. Like, if you're going to be here. If you're not, it's okay. But tell me on the front end. Well, of course, what happens is the thing I said not to do, he was like, I'm here. And I was like, but he came to like part of one chemo treatment. I didn't see him any other time. I called him while I was doing chemo and said that he asked me how I was doing. I said, well, I'm nauseous. And I asked him to bring me some ginger candy. And he brought the stuff like 4 or 5 hours later when I wasn't even nauseous anymore. And that was pretty much the last time I saw him in person, because he kept calling me and saying, how are you? And when I would tell him, he'd be like, oh, that sucks. Not all that sucks, can I? What do you need? And so I just was like, don't ever call me again, because you did the thing that I explicitly told you not to do. Like, yeah. I was like, I have people that don't even live in this state who have been here more for me, and you live around the corner. So, like, go away. So we broke up. But yeah, I just was like, I remember, yeah, it just hit me a whole lot harder emotionally right away. Like, through the whole process, I was very angry. I was pissed off. I was terrified. I felt really guilty again, because again, having to tell my mom this again, having her have to kind of like drop her things. Like, she came here when I started chemo and stayed a couple of months, like, to see me through the process, you know, a couple of weeks, like, through chemo. So, you know, until she felt like I was okay, then she came. Then she went back home, and then she came back when I had to have surgery, because they did more surgery on that side, and that was a whole other ordeal, a whole other time of doctors not listening to me, and I ended up with a hole in my armpit that had to be packed. Like, she had to pack it, and until it filled up, it was a whole thing. It was gross. But through the process, I had a giant blood clot where the surgery had been, where they removed the tissue. So they removed more tissue, basically. And I had a giant blood clot that kept leaking blood, and the people were telling me that it was just a little liquid and not to be concerned. And I was like, what the hell do you mean? Like, I'm bleeding, and I know what the liquid is. This is not the liquid. I've had this surgery before. I know what it looks like. This is blood. And they just kept trying to dismiss, trying to put me out the hospital, like, make me go home. And I was like, well, I tell you what, if y'all just say that it's just a little liquid, I'm just going to have this little liquid be all over y'all stuff. Like, I'm not about to go home and bleed all over my couch.
Right.
So we just going to be here until somebody do something then, if that's the case. So yeah, I had to, you know, get stupid with them again. Whole thing again. So yeah, it just was like, yeah, that's what it was. Now, luckily this time I had already been in therapy. I had just started therapy with a new therapist when I got re-diagnosed. So, like, through the process, I was still in therapy, but I had to process quite a lot. Because just, yeah, like, spiritual, psychological, physical shifts, all at the same time of me trying to find the will to, like, fight,
yeah,
and all of it, because I just feeling it.
Yeah. And how long was the process this time around? So I know the first time it was a few months, but how long was it this time?
Yeah, this time, well, so I froze my eggs before I started chemo, so that was like July. That process took a few weeks, so basically I started like around mid-July and started chemo August 1st. That's my mom's birthday, so more guilt. I started chemo on her birthday. Finished chemo December, had surgery February. Then I had to do radiation for 6 weeks. So basically, almost a year, basically. I started mid-July getting my
eggs frozen.
Eggs removed to be frozen. And I rang my bell for the end of radiation in May. And then I had my chemo port removed in June. So I count June as my second round cancer free day, June 20th.
Okay.
So almost a year.
Wow. Yeah, so I know you wanted to end on like advice that you would give to other people who have to go through this or are experiencing this currently. So yeah, I'll leave the floor to you.
Advice. Well, I just think the main thing, A, is to definitely pay attention to your body. Like, I still don't do the full-on formal dot, 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 this kind of like breast exam. I still don't really do those, but I just pay attention to my body. You know, again, as you are doing whatever you do to get yourself ready for the day, just feel around, and just so that you know when something is not right. So that's the first thing, is just to pay very close attention to your body. Second thing is, if you are, you know, I'm assuming that your audience is mostly Black women. So Black women just have to fight for everything in life in this country. And this is no different. So, you know, no matter what age you are, no matter what socioeconomic background you have, like, are just very conditioned to not listen and not pay attention to Black women unless they are doing something that you need, that someone else needs. Like, unless we are of service to other people, we're invisible, you know, and we're very easy to, people find it very easy to dismiss us for whatever reason. And so you have to be your own biggest advocate. And when you are dealing anything medical, like, you need to have someone that's an advocate for you, but that's also going to be equally as fiercely protective and about you. Because if those people take no for an answer, then they'll still steamroll you if you have someone else there. Like, I didn't get steamrolled because I was very outspoken, but also because the people that I had with me were ready to, like, throw down. And that's really what it came to. Like, it was to the point of, like, calling hospital advocates. I was threatening to call the news. I was specifically naming, like, I feel like y'all are treating me this way because I'm a Black woman and you must think I can't pay. I'm fully insured. And so I'm gonna need y'all to, like, listen to me. And once I said it just like that, then feet got to moving. But every other thing that I said before that, they were being very dismissive of me. And I just have heard so many other stories of that being the case, where it's like, whatever you say or don't say, you know, when you're there, it's just, they'll find any reason to, like, put you at the bottom, think of you last, dismiss you, give you the bare minimum. So you and everybody with you has to be ready to fight hard, name it, say it explicitly, whatever you're feeling, and threaten them, honestly. Like, you do whatever you got to do to make it out alive of the situation, period. Do what you got to do. So if you're going to be the angry Black woman, guess what? They already thought that when you walked in there. That's why they treated you the way that they did. They already thought you were angry just because you are Black and a woman. So I'm gonna be the biggest angry Black bitch that y'all ever saw. That's what I'm gonna be today. But you're going to do right by me before I leave this hospital. And that's really what it is. And so if you and your people are not prepared to do that, then you need to be. So, wow. And therapy, more therapy. And all the things that therapy tells you to do, journaling, eating right, getting some sunshine. But because, you have to take care of your mental and spiritual health through this, and praying alone is not going to cut it. So you got to be doing some other stuff. But yeah, those are my things.
Well, amen to that. thank you so much for joining us, Ryan, and to our audience. Thank you guys for tuning in to this episode of the Girlfriends and Goals podcast. Make sure you follow us on Instagram at Girlfriends and Goals podcast. If you haven't subscribed already, please go ahead and do that now. Don't forget to rate, review, and share. Until next time, bye.
Bye.